J'avais annoncé dans ma leçon, la première de mes leçons, j'avais expliqué à quel point la notion d'intégration était contestée. Elle était contestée de façon parfois radicale. Et j'ai voulu aujourd'hui donner la parole à des chercheurs qui contestent radicalement la notion d'intégration. Je crois qu'il faut les entendre, les écouter. Je ne suis pas toujours, loin de là, d'accord avec leurs arguments, comme je l'expliquerai. Je pense qu'on peut sauver la notion d'intégration à certaines conditions, mais qu'il faut évidemment préciser, et comme j'essaie de le faire dans mon cours et comme certains chercheurs l'ont fait aussi dans d'autres séances du séminaire, je crois qu'il est important aujourd'hui d'écouter deux sons de cloche très forts sur la notion d'intégration, ses limites, la connexion qu'elle a avec notamment le passé colonial, qui est évidemment une question tout à fait importante. Et donc, nous avons le plaisir aujourd'hui de recevoir Willem Schinkel, c'est comme ça qu'on prononce en néerlandais, non pas Schinkel. Donc, Willem Schinkel est professeur dans l'une des universités les plus prestigieuses des Pays-Bas, l'université Erasmus, allusion évidemment à Erasme. Et il a publié récemment, je crois que c'était à Cambridge University Press, un livre sur sa conception de l'intégration dans une perspective qui est européenne et mondiale, dans une perspective comparative. C'est donc un chercheur qui a un background, comme on dit en bon anglais, extrêmement solide, et c'est un honneur pour nous de recevoir Willem Schinkel. Ensuite, Patrick Simon, s'il arrive à nous rejoindre, ce que j'espère, ça va, nous avons de bonnes nouvelles de sa part, viendra aussi. Il nous fera une déclaration concernant la situation de la recherche actuellement, parce que vous savez peut-être qu'il y a un mouvement assez intense d'opposition à la loi de programmation pluriannuelle de la recherche qui est prévue pour février. Et une partie des chercheurs sont très remontés contre ce projet. Donc, il nous fera. Un certain nombre de laboratoires sont en grève d'ailleurs contre cette. Donc, il y aura une déclaration sur ce sujet. En fonction des circonstances, je ferai moi-même ma petite déclaration qui ne sera pas nécessairement la même que celle de Patrick Simon. Et ensuite, il devrait nous faire, m'a-t-il dit, un exposé, peut-être raccourci en tout cas, un exposé sur sa propre manière de voir l'intégration, puisque Patrick Simon est quelqu'un qui a beaucoup travaillé sur la question de l'intégration. C'est à lui, enfin c'est à un collectif de chercheurs, dont Patrick Simon, que l'on doit notamment la fameuse enquête Théo, Trajectoire et Origine, qui est la référence fondamentale, enquête menée en 2008-2009, et qui, dont un remake, je vais encore utiliser, dont une nouvelle version est en ce moment sur le terrain. Donc une nouvelle enquête Théo en 2020 est sur le terrain après celle de 2008-2009. C'est un peu le problème que nous avons en France, c'est que nous étudions l'intégration des premières générations, des secondes générations. Il y aura même des questions sur la troisième génération dans Théo 2, mais nous le faisons à intervalles très, très éloignés. Il y a quand même dans l'enquête emploi, le Labour Force Survey, dans l'enquête emploi française, il y a aussi évidemment des questions sur les origines des parents, les origines des individus, et on peut étudier les discriminations dont sont victimes par exemple les personnes de la deuxième génération, leurs chances d'accession à l'emploi, au logement, etc. Mais pas évidemment de façon aussi détaillée que dans les grandes enquêtes de recherche très poussées que sont les enquêtes Théo. Enquête Théo, je rappelle, son statut, c'est un statut fort, hein, c'est une réalisation conjointe de l'INSEE, l'Institut National de la Statistique, et de l'INED, l'Institut National d'Études Démographiques. Et donc, ce sont des enquêtes qui sont soumises à des contrôles extrêmement solides, hein, du Conseil National de l'Information Statistique, d'une part, de la Commission Nationale de l'Informatique et des Libertés, donc l'équivalent de la High Authority for Protection of Private Data. Et ce sont donc des enquêtes qui sont, on ne peut pas poser n'importe quelle question, mais dont la finalité reconnue permet finalement d'aller beaucoup plus loin que les dispositifs statistiques actuels. Donc Patrick Simon est très engagé, a joué un rôle considérable dans la mise au point de ces enquêtes. Il a dirigé pendant pas mal d'années l'unité de recherche sur les migrations au sein de l'INED, et il est actuellement le responsable du département Integer sur l'intégration, l'exclusion, la discrimination au sein de l'Institut des migrations dont je m'occupe pour le compte du CNRS et de quelques autres associations. Voilà, les présentations sont faites et donc je cède la parole à Willem Schrinkel.
Merci beaucoup pour l'invitation au Collège de France. Je m'excuse de parler en anglais, même si je lis en français, je ne pourrais préparer une conférence entière. Et en général, une conversation informelle est beaucoup plus difficile pour moi que de lire Bourdieu. Donc ce ne serait pas une bonne idée de vous parler en français. Alors nous devrons nous contenter de ce qui est malheureusement le langage hégémonique qui nous relie. Alors l'anglais, j'espère qu'elle nous relie. So again, thank you so much for the invitation to speak here, in particular to Professor Héran for convening this series and to Laura Odesso for her kind assistance and also to Khalid Benhamad for the practicalities of getting me here. And thanks also to Patrick Simon, who's not yet here, for the invitation and I hope for his words to come. So it's a great honor for me to be at the Collège de France, because when I was still a student, I received a letter from Pierre Bourdieu in regard to a piece I wrote about his work. And so ever since, the address of the Collège de France has had this magical ring to it. And although he probably would have demystified that immediately, I'm very glad and honored to be here with you, because he died before I could have a chance to meet him. Now, I'll speak about immigrant integration and about the very meaning also of the concept of migration, because in order to understand what, in my view, are the problems with the concept of immigrant integration, we need to understand what we are actually talking about when we talk about migration. So this is what I'll talk about today. What investments need to be enacted in order to have integration and migration as objects of study? So what kind of things do we have to accept or already believe in once we start to talk about integration and migration? And one context of speaking about immigrant integration is the political trope of the failure of multiculturalism. And here we immediately see that something is wrong, because when Nicolas Sarkozy, Angela Merkel, and David Cameron all denounced the multiculturalism in their societies as having failed, it was clear that they could not have been speaking about the same thing. These countries did not have similar policies. And France, for sure, has never been multicultural in any serious sense of the term. So, should we look at the social science of immigrant integration then and leave the politicization behind us? Well, if only it were that easy. As I will show, immigrant integration in its scientific uses is riddled with paradoxes that stem from its always already political character. And these start with the very concept of integration. Originally, this is a concept applied to a biological or social whole, so to a society in its entirety, for instance. Or my body can be well integrated, and it can also disintegrate, and then I die. But how do we generally use immigrant integration? We apply it to individuals. So an individual migrant can be said to be well integrated. But can a migrant be said to be disintegrated? Of course not. An individual cannot be socially disintegrated. And here we start to see a weirdness in the use of the concept. And that weirdness has everything to do with the fact that immigrant integration presupposes a realm that is always presupposed, but that no one has ever really seen. It presupposes society. Society as a national and yet quasi-natural thing. Society as that in which migrants are said to integrate. And when they are not yet integrated, they are said to be at a remove from society. They are still outside society, as the saying goes. In other words, those who are in need of migration or of integration are here, and yet they are not. French immigrants in need of integration are in France, not in the Netherlands or in Germany, and yet they are not quite here. This is the idea. Or in yet other words, these migrants have arrived, and yet they have not yet fully arrived. They have a temporal lag. They are lagging behind in a way. They are stuck, for instance, in traditional ways in the past that they need integration from in order to catch up with modernity, with civilization, with France, with society. And this is the conventional reasoning, and I'm obviously very critical of this reasoning. A number of asymmetries illustrate what's at stake here. Why are only recent immigrants and their descendants researched in terms of their integration? Why have most white people received what you could call a dispensation of integration? So why is integration, for instance, not an issue when it comes to me? Similarly, why do many Europeans think that ethnic is a concept that only refers to others? In my country, in the Netherlands, for instance, when people say that they go out to an ethnic restaurant, they go to a Moroccan restaurant, for instance. And when they eat Dutch, they eat spaghetti or pizza. You have to understand that la cuisine hollandaise n'existe pas. So why this dispensation of integration? The reason is that immigrant integration operates as a racialized technique of purification. Whenever there is a problem, it appears that it's not society's problem, but the problem of people still outside of society. When a person commits a crime, for instance, he or she is to be reintegrated. And so crime becomes an issue of people outside society, an issue that's not really a part of society because it's an issue that has to do with people who need to be integrated, who are not yet fully a part of society. Likewise, when socioeconomic inequality is an issue, it pertains to people still at a remove from society. So the society imagined in talk of immigrant integration becomes a counterfactual, morally purified realm in which no problems exist whatsoever. And indeed, immigrant integration is one way of sustaining exactly that, a particular imagination of society. And my point would be that we should analyze such imaginaries rather than work directly in the surface of them. As sociologists, we should not accept such an imagination, but research how such an imagination is produced and perpetuated. Because why would crime not be a part of society? Why are those at the bottom of what is sustained as a socioeconomic hierarchy, why are those at the bottom of that hierarchy not a part of society? Not part of the hierarchy, but not integrated. What a weird way of crafting sociological concepts this is. In other words, why add insult to injury when people are poor by telling them that not only they are poor, they are also not well integrated? What kind of acceptance of a very particular concept of society do we have to share? And how can we be scientists if we already accept that particular notion of society? And if you're skeptical about this, consider some of the features of measuring immigrant integration. In the Netherlands, as in many European countries where this is a longer standing practice, I know, and perhaps Patrick will talk about the problems that exist in France in trying to measure immigrant integration, but in many European countries, social-cultural integration is, for instance, measured by considering how modern people are, which is reduced to their degree of secularity, which is then reduced to being church-going. So Dutch society, for instance, it's reasoned, is secular in this way. Now, when immigration has, over the years, given rise to over 1 million people in the Netherlands calling themselves Muslim, one might reason that, well, Dutch society has changed. But then comes the logic of this research, which is to say, no, Dutch society has stayed exactly the same. It's just that there are now 1 million people residing more or less outside of it. But how can that be an empirical statement? And why would ideological or religious division not be a part of society? Why are only some people in that divide considered in terms of their lacking integration? There can only be one answer. It's because society is a normative ideal, a wishful image that's propped up by prevailing powers. And of course it is a highly racialized image, because in the very neutralized and scientific language of immigrant integration, it problematizes almost exclusively non-white people. Whether one would want to do that or not is, of course, a political question. One might say, for instance, that those already on French soil have a first say in how one should conduct oneself there. But let's just note then that there is and cannot be anything sociological about such an investment in a highly historically particular form of society. So there's nothing descriptive about immigrant integration. It is always a prescriptive concept. And the real divide here is not between people who are well integrated and people who are not well integrated, but between people problematized in terms of integration and people not problematized in these terms at all. And that is the asymmetry that is an active work of imagining rather than analyzing society. So in other words, what immigrant integration does is to help create and sustain the very gap between society and its outside of immigrants in need of integration that it is claimed to help overcome. It's a concept of best intentions, for sure, but it gets us stuck in arrested notions of what this purified domain of society is. So society functions like a Comtean or Durkheimian god. She is everywhere, but nobody has ever seen her. And for social science, immigrant integration today is one way of solving the problem of circumscribing its mystical master concept, society. And if we are to understand this all too obvious implication of social science in highly particular ideals of society, we cannot forego the fact that all of this has to do with the problematization of people mostly from former European colonies in what are post-colonial conditions. There really is this idea that there simply are internally closed societies now facing migration out of the blue, meaning that these societies, themselves completely unchanged, are faced with people they need to integrate. But one can really very readily discern in immigrant integration the same logic that the Caribbean thinker Sylvia Winter describes in the use of the concept of development when she says, the West is now going to reincorporate us neocolonially and thereby mimetically by telling us that the problem with us wasn't that we'd been imperially subordinated, wasn't that we'd been both socioculturally dominated and economically exploited, but that we were underdeveloped. And in Europe today, I believe nobody has said this better with respect to the demand to integrate than Julia Boutelja here in France. Boutelja speaks of a white immune system, ever present in France, but much more generally in Western European, in which equality, French republicanism, for instance, has acted as a way to naturalize and invisibilize racial hierarchies. And Buttigieg discusses the bizarre sociologists that seek to objectify from afar the integration of immigrants. And she makes attentive to the fact that what goes by the name of integration has its historical antecedents in colonial history. And what are now called immigrants in Europe are in so many ways part of the delayed or ongoing responses to the initial plunder conducted in the name of Europe. As Buttigieg says, they were born wretched of the earth and they ended up immigrants. So in order to fully understand the way immigrant integration works, we need to follow up on Buttigieg's claim here and consider how migration is the primary way in which race, ever denied as still relevant, is done in Europe. And so I will now turn to the concept of migration, and I want to ask, how does migration studies have its object? Or how does migration become an object that is then available to a variety of publics? And perhaps you are tempted to answer that it first of all takes people that migrate. But whether the movement that a body has performed gets to be migration is not in the hands of that body. As those of you involved in the standardization of migration statistics will know, migration is not simply people moving from one place to another. One cannot be a migrant, one can be counted as a migrant. And one can be interpolated as a migrant, obviously to the degree that many people see themselves in terms of being a migrant, and that's not something I wish to dispute or denounce in any way. But the phenomenon of migration only really comes into view when it comes into view, literally. It occurs when people's mobility is captured by an official apparatus of registration, by states mostly, but state actors operate in tandem with others, including social scientists, in visualizing migration. And here the visualizing is the constitution. Migration is nothing but the accounting according to which these and these bodies, originally from this territory, are now in that territory. But the territories, of course, do not pre-exist the phenomenon of migration, because the visualization of migration is today a primary way in which the imaginary objects we call nation-states gain credibility. What is more, migration accounting is an accounting that not only makes claims about the bodies of those it counts as migrants. It is always, and at the same time, a practice that gives an account of its own situatedness. It is from here, from this being in place, that those who come from there, those who are out of place, are counted. And this accounting thereby always establishes a relation. So already that accounting of migration makes it very weird to say, well, migrants are here, but actually they're not really here. Let me make an analogy here, and the analogy is with birds and the migration of birds. Now, representations of human migration and bird migration often look very similar. These are the birds, these are the humans. And there are often flow charts with those big arrows that actually have meteorological origins. This is Edmund Halley's map of the trade winds from 1686, and it's probably the first flow chart, and these are what are used in the study of migration, both of birds and humans. But they were made famous as depictions of invasions, as Napoleon's invasion of Russia by Mina in 1812. And in migration studies, Ravenstein was probably the first to apply flowcharts to migration in 1885. But maps of migrating birds and humans are treated in entirely different ways, because the registration of birds and humans is very different. When birds are said to migrate, they do not go from a place of belonging to a place of non-belonging. Rather, Their migration is the enactment of an extended topology. That simply is their habitat. Humans may think otherwise. For instance, when in the Netherlands, the godwit is chosen as the archetypical Dutch national bird, as it was chosen. When next to breeding from the UK to Eastern Asia, it migrates, and those frequenting the Netherlands spend half their time in Africa. So if you see, this is a very weird idea to say, oh, this is the Dutch national bird, right? Why would it be the Dutch national bird? But it seems to me that this idea that where a body is, it simply is, makes perfect sense. Only once nation states are conjured up does it seem logical to assume that bodies can be in but not of a place, and that they are, that they not simply are where they are, but that there's something wrong with where they are, that they are not really there, that they belong elsewhere, that they should move on or go back, or that they should first integrate before they have really arrived where they are already located. Now, with the migration of birds, the reference space for their migration is Earth. With people, the reference space is the international system of nation states. But these are not on a par, these are not similar categories. Nation states are claims on Earth, attempted but always failing transformations of Earth into world, into legal territories. And only after we sign up to support nation states bounded by borders can we have the objective facts about migration. But what if the scientific distance, called objectivity, is precisely the distance from which migration is ontologically constituted in the first place? What if migration is an object that can only be constituted in this way from afar? In that case, the reality of migration is the reality of an apparatus of visualization, of registration, of accounting. So migration is never then an exogenous phenomenon, an incursion into and onto the territory that the nation already occupies. It's an endogenous phenomenon. And in order to understand how this is the case, it's necessary to track mobile bodies and to place bodies on hold, to imprison them for states, to search them, to scan them, to register them, to interrogate them. This is how the very phenomenon of migration gets its reality. But at no point in the intimacy of all those encounters can one say, yes, here it is, this is migration. And a key role is played by standardization here. The 1924 International Conference on E-Migration and Immigration in Rome adopted the first standard definitions of migration out of a twofold desire for comparability and regulation. And among the first institutions to standardize migration was the International Labour Office, which is primarily interested in charting migration because of its assumed consequences for employment. Now, these problems of standardization persist. My colleagues today still have not found a unitary definition of migration. But the point is that the very effort at standardization already creates the thing to be standardized, if only as a thing to be cared for all practical purposes, assumed to exist and precede the standardization. So, in other words, in the very effort to render things comparable, there is always already the assumption of comparability, the assumption that these things are of the same kind. And that's less an assumption than an effect of efforts to standardize. So migration is born as an object of attention and of problematization with a view to both regulation and to its costs for labor populations. It's born out of states' desires for regulation, capital's desires for labor differentiation, and statisticians' desires for comparison. But it is born in a very specific context. In Europe, migration only really starts to become an issue after the demise of empire. In their time, European colonial settlers were not called or counted as migrants. The moment migrants become a matter of concern is the moment a colonial empire reaches its tipping point. And when that happens, all the ways in which these migrants were always already entangled with Europe become invisibilized. So migration becomes a concern when movement is reversed, when Europe becomes receiving country. And the end of empire also marks the birth of European unification with 1957, the Ghanaian independence, and the Treaty of Rome as a symbolic marker. But European unification was from the start conceived as a neocolonial project that should assure access to African resources as a form of development. As the chairman of the Economic Committee of the Council of Europe in 1952, Paul Reynaud, said then, "We must also, if free Europe is to be made viable, jointly exploit the riches of the African continent and try to find there those raw materials which we are getting from the dollar area and for which we are unable to pay." Now, the flip side of this project P.O. Hansen and Stefan Johnson have called Eurafrica was that it would be impossible not to contribute to the mobility of Africans towards Europe. In Marxist terms, the flow of constant capital would accompany a flow of variable capital of workers. And so migration became a priority object of policy in European countries under these very specific conditions. So migration marks the continuing presence of a colonial divide. And as such, it often masks and makes invisible the continuing presence of the differential and intersectional workings of race. It is under conditions of the loss of direct colonial dominance that it becomes relevant to keep track of who goes where, who can and cannot move, who belongs where, or in other words, which blood is connected with which soil. In the early 19th century, none of the European countries were tracking where people went. They were simply not interested. People could move from one country to another, as they frequently did, as they always have done. So, of course, the state's accounting here is always and necessarily incomplete, and so social science became enrolled in the networks of complicity out of which migration emerges as both a scientific object and an object of government. So let me conclude by giving you finally a conceptualization of migration, of what migration is under these conditions. First of all, we can say that empire lives on, but in a kind of warped and wrinkled way. In the 19th century, empire could be represented as a horizontal plane, a smooth space tending toward infinity. Currently, it exists as a striated space, a warped and wrinkled topology of finite folds that multiply the colonial divide. So the colonial divide potentially appears around each corner, where gentrification sorts and separates migrant populations from native populations. It structures labor conditions where migrant workers largely perform the invisible work and the most exploitative labor. It figures in school segregation and in academic hierarchies and their diversity, or rather lack thereof. And it figures in the myriad ways in which those coded as migrants are burdened with the one-sided demand to integrate, even though the very logic of that integration keeps them at a distance, perpetuates the difference between them and their society. So what is euphemistically nowadays called super diversity in migration science, is, I think, the latest way of, on the one hand, recognizing this complexity of a warped and wrinkled empire, but of, on the other hand, refusing to work with the vocabularies of those who recognize this all along, refusing to speak of race and the colonial divide. So let's return to the seemingly simple account, this is a migrant. This is a migrant is a way of saying this person with whom I live together is in fact not fully here because she might not have been here. This is what migrants are, people that might not have been here. I think this is the key. In a way, there is always a parallel bookkeeping. On the one hand, there is the record of what society is now that migrants are there. On the other hand, there is the record of what society would have been if those migrants would never have come, as if that somehow is a reality. So to say this is a migrant is to say this is a person who might not have been here. It's a way of subsuming a person under a Malthusian surplus population. And as such, it's a way of saying, this person owes me something. Because I was already here, and I tolerate and legitimate her presence here. So to say this is a migrant is a double statement of worth. It at once valorizes the speaker as a non-migrant, as a person that has stayed on native soil, on the territory in which he or she has primordial rights, we call citizenship, and it indicates a direction of the Jews, of who owes whom. In other words, to say this is a migrant is a statement of debt. If you've been mobile, if you have traveled from the land to which your being is magically connected, then we might tolerate you, because we are liberal here in Western Europe. But you owe us. That is the effect of what migration does. So it's to say you are in debt with us. Since you moved while we have not left our primordial entanglement between blood and soil. Save, of course, for the centuries of the colonial constitution of the contemporary, about which we have nothing more to say. Because no debt is ours. That's long ago. That wasn't us. So there are no need for reparations, but in the face of a thing called migration, there is every need to talk about what post-colonial migrants owe their host societies. And this is why migrants have a duty to integrate, why one can speak of the costs of migration for society, why there are frequent calls for austerity for migrants. Okay, people from Syria can come to Western Europe, but their conditions should be austere. They should suffer a little so that they don't think about staying. These are literal political pleas that are being made. They're all possible because of the logic of the concept of integration as saying, this is a person, a migrant is a person who might not have been here. So it's a person that is in debt to us. So the logic here is that society can only bear so much integration, and as so much migration, sorry. And as a thing to bear, then, migration is a modality of debt. And that debt is paid along the folds of our warped empire, with every displacement by gentrification, every fall into poverty by job discrimination, every demand to integrate, every racialized asymmetry in education systems. All of these are reparations without repair. Reparations for the thing that registered as migration, for the account and the interpolation, hey you, migrant. This becomes most visible in the case of economic migrants, where that debt appears as a crime, no longer as the moralized dues of being on other people's soil, but as the debt of indebtedness itself. So there is a double bookkeeping here. There's a record of what society would be like if those called migrants would not be here, and a record of what extra costs are due now that they are here. So hovering over the heads of immigrants, remains the record of an ideal, less costly society in which they simply did not exist. And it is to that ideal that they must make sacrifices. So therefore, there are repeated calls for the austerity for migrants who should not be cushioned, but have to fight their way in, as the Dutch Prime Minister said. But migration also facilitates the multiplication of labor, the fact that people circulate at different speeds with different rates of exploitation. Ultimately, of course, the debt due by migrants is precisely the way those who consider themselves citizens know that it could be worse. It is how they are pacified to accept exploitative conditions themselves, knowing they are, after all, better off than those not cushioned by the symbolic privileges of the nation. So, I'll come back to my beginning. How scientific is it to start to assess migration and immigrant integration? Why accept all the ideological muddiness of these concepts rather than study what happens when immigration and immigrant integration are enacted? Why be a priori invested in the imagination of society that these concepts presuppose? Why start to analyze what happens in the world only after one has accepted as inescapable fact the current realities of nation states, nationally bounded labor markets, global governmentality regimes, and of the migration that shows up therein? It's really as if a natural scientist would start her explorations of matter by assuming that tables and chairs are among the smallest building blocks of the world. Tables and chairs are already ongoing compositions of matter. And as Spinoza says, there are good and bad compositions, compositions that allow us to flourish, to experience joy, and compositions that give rise to pain, ultimately to decompositions. So when we are invested in migration, it is important to account for the ways in which that investment may indeed be an imposition that hampers the composition of a common world. So the question is, when do we start living together? And how do we invent concepts that start from the fact of living together, however unequally and asymmetrically, without discursively expunging racialized others from the very terrain of these inequalities and asymmetries altogether? Thank you.